If you wish to become a complete and wise leader, you must embrace a larger view of the Force.
Welcome, everyone. My name is Devore, and you are listening to episode 39 of A Larger View of the Force, a Star Wars podcast. A reminder, as always, if this is your first time listening, please go back and check out the earlier episodes of this show and make sure to subscribe so you keep up to date with new episodes as they come out. Today, we are looking back at the six-part limited series Obi-Wan Kenobi, which at the time of this recording wrapped up exactly 1 week ago. And so we're going to be talking, we're going to basically be breaking down the show, talk about the story that we got, talk about some of the big themes, some of the ways maybe that it has added to the prequels, to the original trilogy, to our understanding of these characters and other additions that it has made to the Star Wars universe. Because I think even though it is only six episodes, I think there is a lot in here, and I think it is really become a kind of seminal, essential element of Star Wars storytelling. And I have joining me for this conversation a very, very special guest. She has quite a CV that I will not do justice here, but I will at least get some of it. She is a writer for StarWars.com. She is the author of Marvel Monsters, the Vader Immortal digital art book. She is also the author of the forthcoming book, Be More Obi-Wan, and also the co-author with Ashley Eckstein of Star Wars Every Day, which is set to come out later in 2022. Dad joke extraordinaire, Kelly Knox, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, thank you for coming on. You have the distinction of being the first official Star Wars person who has come onto the show. It's like someone who has actually... written for StarWars.com, has like a licensed book and everything. Yes. So
I am a Star Wars person. Yep.
Yes. Yeah. You are part of the officialdom. So I'm very glad that you are on here and that we get to talk about this show, because of course, one of the big reasons that I asked you on is that you've literally written a book on Obi-Wan Kenobi. So you are very much an expert in the field of this character. So before we get into talking about the show itself, I'm going to ask you the thing that I always ask every first time guest, is to talk a little bit about your journey into Star Wars, how you became a fan and such. And then also, because it's going to be relevant for this topic in our conversation, as part of that, talk a little bit about your history with the character of Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Sure. So I'm a little older, so I grew up with the original trilogy. We had like the three movies taped off at HBO watched on our VCR over and over. I think I watched the first one more than any other, and I've got it all memorized still. And I remember seeing Return of the Jedi in the theater, so that's an indication of how old I am. But when I was growing up, it wasn't really considered a quote unquote girl thing to like Star Wars. And so it was like a very personal kind of fandom. And so even now I have trouble sometimes even talking about it, even considering what my job is to write about it and talk about it. But in person, I still get a little bit nervous because I was always kind of made fun of as a kid for talking about Star Wars. So it's nice that things have changed. As for Obi-Wan, I mean, well, I guess I could keep going on my Star Wars journey. I guess a long story short, lifelong fan. I worked on Star Wars professionally as the community manager for Star Wars Galaxies around 2007, 2008. And then after that, I became a freelance writer, and that's when I started writing for Star Wars around 2015 or 2016. So that's my journey into Star Wars. And as for Obi-Wan, I've always loved his little quips in the first movie the most. I think I've said it quite a few times, but his who's the more foolish, the fool or the fool who follows him was just like my favorite line probably in the whole movie. And it like I used that advice in real life several times. And so he's always been a character that I've really enjoyed and looked up to. And then, of course, I loved Ewan McGregor and the prequels, and The Phantom Menace is one of my favorite. It's actually in my top three because of Obi-Wan. And so, yeah, that's me in Star Wars, probably a little longer than you wanted.
Oh, no, not at all. It's perfect. It's perfect. All right. So, yeah, so we got that. So, you know, that is a good kind of point to transition to talking about Obi-Wan Kenobi, the TV show, a thing that has been, as many people have pointed out, has been many, many years in the coming. It was a thing that was going to originally be a movie back when a Star Wars story things were a thing. And then when that stopped being a thing, it was retooled into this limited series. Ewan McGregor spent many, many years denying that he was not involved in any way. Then we learned to the contrary that in fact he was involved and knew about it for a long time. And so, yeah, this has been something that as a fandom we have been expecting and looking forward to and been talking about for a very long time. And so I kind of just, before we kind of talk about the show itself, I want to talk a little bit about that run up. So what were your thoughts and feelings, expectations, etc., about the Obi-Wan show in the kind of lead up to it?
So I remember, like you said, we've all talked about it for a long time, wanting to see, you know, the story of where he was at during those 19 odd years that he lived on Tatooine. I know we had gotten a taste of it in the comics and Jason Aaron's run, but it was always kind of that dream film or dream series, I think, for almost every Star Wars fan. I remember when they announced it, I literally started jumping up and down, and I was upstairs and my husband was downstairs, and he yelled up like, "What is happening?" Because I was jumping so much. I was just beyond excited when they announced it, and it has certainly lived up to all my expectations, and it was just as emotional and it's as deep as a character study, I think, that we could have hoped for.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with you on that. And we will, of course, get into some of those character study elements in our conversation. You know, for me, I was, of course, excited for the show. It's more Star Wars content, so naturally I'm going to be excited about that. There were some hesitations that I had about it back when we didn't really know what it was going to be about, and it was in the kind of rumor speculation and stage, and people were talking about their expectations and such. And there were really kind of two elements that in particular I, like, for a long time was a little uneasy about, that ended up being very fundamental to the show we got, and I ended up changing my feelings about it once I actually got to see it. One of those was the prospect of Obi-Wan leaving Tatooine, because it sort of felt for me that, like, the notion of the Jedi in exile was such a powerful idea. And so the thought that, oh, for all those 19 years, he was just there and Luke was his entire world. And so the thought, the prospect of, well, he was going to just take a break from that for a little bit and jot off to some other adventures. I don't know. I don't know how I feel about that. Like, would he really do that? And then the other thing, the other source of unease or hesitation was the prospect of a Vader showdown in between Revenge of the Sith and A New Hope. Because I was, for a time, I was one of those people that, like, oh yeah, you know, like, when I left you, I was but the learner, now I am the master. Like, that was Mustafar, or a presence I haven't felt since, you know, that he was referring to Mustafar there. And so I thought, like, well, if there's some meeting or meetings, however many, in the time in between, does that kind of in any way diminish or cheapen or whatever what happens in A New Hope? Short answer, it does not. But we will talk about that. Yeah, so those are the things that those were elements of the show that or that people were talking about that would might happen that I was like, I don't know if I necessarily want to see that. And then, of course, once we both knew what was going to happen, which is that we were going to get a kind of outside of Tatooine mission and that we were going to get the return of Vader, the rematch of the century, as Kathleen Kennedy called it.
Mm-hmm.
And then actually getting to see it. You know, that really kind of changed my perspective, my feelings on all of that.
Right.
So let's get into the actual meat of the show itself. So I think the way that I want to kind of structure the conversation, rather than kind of going through episode by episode or part by part, rather, and talking about the kind of plot itself, is I kind of want to look at really two big themes or ideas that the show engages with. And then in the midst of that, talk about the characters and the journeys, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
First off, actually, before I do that, do I actually step back? Because I know that you were at Celebration in Anaheim at the end of May. And,
yes.
And I was too. Did you view the first two episodes in the stage?
I did. So I had I saved my regular like 4-day pass, and I used that to enter the lotto, and I got into the screening, that Lucasfilm showcase in the screening. So yes, I did actually get to see the first two episodes in the arena with everybody.
I have such an annoying story about that. So we were at Celebration. To just give some context for folks who are listening who may not have gone to Celebration or don't know how these things work, the way it worked for Anaheim is that each day of the 4 days, there was one kind of main panel that was happening on the main stage. And then there were two satellite stages where everything that was happening on the main stage was streamed. And then there was a lottery system for people to enter in order to get into one of three stages for each of these daily kind of big main panels. And we had gotten we had won the lottery for one of the satellite stages.
Oh, uh-huh.
But once we got in through the giant line, we got in, we didn't know where it was because they just kind of toss you into the exhibit hall.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were struggling to make our way around, and we found this random elevator that took us to this weird floor because we just didn't know how the convention center was structured. So we missed the Lucasfilm. So we didn't get in to see it. Yeah.
No.
I will forever be salty about that. It's fine.
Did you go back for the evening screening?
No.
Maybe
we could have still gotten in. I don't know how it worked.
Ugh. Yeah, it was sort of chaotic. Yeah.
So we just watched in our hotel room. But
that's okay, though. I mean,
yeah.
I did have to go back and watch it again to hear some, not to rub it in, but there was screaming and yelling at some parts. And
right.
So it was easy to miss the next line of dialogue. So I did go back and watch it again.
Right. And so one of the things that the show deals with and is really a kind of through line through a lot of the storytelling that happens in the quote unquote dark times in these 19 years that are kind of bookmarked by, you've got on the front end of it is the Bad Batch, which kind of starts right after Revenge of the Sith and the formation of the Empire. And then the back end of it is Rebels and kind of Rogue One with the coming out of the Rebel Alliance. And then you've got stuff in between, like Obi-Wan Kenobi, like a Jedi Fallen Order. In a few months from the time this is recording and coming out, we're going to have Cassian Andor, which is also in this period. Very excited about that one. A kind of through line through all of those stories in this period is this pretty much the specter of the Empire and of authoritarianism and how different characters in all these stories are responding to this presence.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's something that we very much get to see in the context of Obi-Wan Kenobi, the show. We're seeing all of these different characters and how they're reacting to the existence of this empire. And one of the things that I think really came through to me when watching the show, it was something that, of course, was true in other contexts of Star Wars media that has dealt with, whether it is in, let's say, a Rebels or a Fallen Order or elsewhere, is the way it really leans into the notion of the Jedi as a kind of persecuted group.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you've got all of these trappings and all these like metaphors of it, like whether it is the whole show opening with Order 66 and getting a new perspective on that and seeing the initial purge, and whether it is the Inquisitors, that you have this little body of the Empire that is specifically focused on hunting down this population, whether it is something like, and we'll talk about this more with the characters involved in it, was something like The Path, mm-hmm. this kind of network to ferry off these folks who are being hunted. So I really like the way that it leaned into a lot of those metaphors or those trappings of what it's like to be a Jedi in this period. So, you know, from there we can sort of start by, you know, looking at the first character, and we can talk about how he's kind of dealing with the Imperial presence, and that is the titular Obi-Wan Kenobi. One place that I want to start with talking about Obi-Wan is something that you've talked about on Twitter a couple times that I've seen, is you've talked about this idea of this kind of the kind of dualism of Obi-Wan and Ben,
mm-hmm.
and how these names kind of symbolize different facets of who he is at different points in his life. So I want to just kind of start off this whole conversation by talking about that a little bit.
I think he says it in the first episode. He says, I'm not who I used to be. And I don't think he's just talking about changing his name. I think he's talking about things like the remorse that he feels and seeing his actions during the Clone Wars, probably his failures, and learning not to trust anybody. Like, I think that's more what he's talking about rather than just a name change. And that's why, like you said, I've talked about the duality of who he was in the Clone Wars and in Revenge of the Sith and everything else, and then who he's going to be in A New Hope, which is a lot more confident. He immediately accepts that he's Ben and he's Obi-Wan when Luke asks him, you know, that where he points to himself and says, of course I know him, he's me. Like, I feel like that the series is the whole journey of how he gets from that one point to that point. And I think that's what makes it so interesting, and that he might insist that he's not still Obi-Wan, but you can see that he is. He's mistrustful, he's remorseful, but he is still Obi-Wan.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that comes through in a couple of moments early on in the show. I mean, the at first, when we kind of are introduced to him, particularly in part one, like, we see the ways in which he is very much trying to keep his head down, where like we get the kind of initial opening scene when he's in the, like, I don't know, like the meat packing area. I don't even know what you call that. Like,
yeah.
When they're harvesting the stingray. Like,
somebody on Twitter called him a sushi miner, like the mining, which I think is so funny.
I really sushi love that. Miner. Yeah. I think that's very good. Yeah. Sushi miner. I think that is his occupation. And there's, you know, there's that little moment where they're all clocking out of the time gonk, and the one worker complains about getting cheated out of his wages, and then the boss confronts him, and then Obi-Wan like doesn't say anything. He just kind of keeps walking.
Right.
You know, you get that whole confrontation with the runaway Jedi Nari, which I think is really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I think you get in some of there, you get kind of what you were talking about with the Obi-Wan Ben dualism, where the guy comes up to him and he's like, you're Obi-Wan Kenobi. He's like, no, you're wrong, I'm Ben.
Yeah.
And so he tries to play it off, and, you know, Nari is trying to say, like, well, what happened to you? Like, you were a great Jedi. Like, why aren't you, like, what are you doing out here? And he's pretty much like, you know, he has that line, the fight is done, we lost.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what's interesting, and this is something that the show really explores, and it's not something that I even really kind of thought about before the show presented in this way, is that part of his attitude of, again, keeping his head down, not causing trouble, you know, not getting involved, part of it is a function of his mission, the reason that he's on Tatooine. It is mm-hmm. to protect Luke, and so he can't really draw attention to himself. But then I think another thing that the show really highlights is how a lot of that is coming from his own lack of confidence and his own kind of defeatism in the moment.
Yeah, I agree. I think I've said the difference it's not the Force or the Jedi that he lost faith in, it's himself. And I think that's where he's coming from for a lot of like his misgivings about, you know, the way he reacts when he sees the clone trooper, the way he snaps at Leia about, you know, we can't just trust anybody. I feel like he's seeing that more as one of his own failings for being too trusting before.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, to your point where you were talking about how even though he's trying to kind of put some distance between who he is now and like who he once was as Obi-Wan and, you know, the identity that he's kind of adopted as Ben, like that the fact of Obi-Wan still sticking around, like I think about that conversation that he has with Nari where he tells him like what to do and he says, just go out into the desert, bury your lightsaber somewhere and then just walk away and forget all of it. And that's on the one hand, that's advice that he gives to Nari, but then as we see later, that's not advice that he himself is living by.
Right.
Because he knows where his own lightsaber is. Like he buries it, but he makes a note of where it is in case he ever needs it. So he is kind of projecting this notion of, okay, I'm out of the fight. It's over. But there's still that morsel that he's clinging on to. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of that tension and that all and his own kind of struggles with what happened, particularly with Anakin and so on, really comes to the fore with the main plotline, which is the kidnapping of Leia, which, again, to kind of talk about that, like, once again, like a Star Wars show, another example of a Star Wars show baiting and switching us in just the best way.
Yeah.
Like, you see all the promos and you think everything, oh, this is going to be an Obi-Wan Luke story. And then it's like however many minutes it was into part one and we're on Alderaan and all of a sudden we're like, oh, okay, this is not the show that we think it's going to be.
Right.
So that was just delightful to get. And, you know, once you get the kidnapping of Leia and you have Bail and Brea reaching out to him to try to get him to go after her because, you know, as Bail said, you know, he's the only other person who knows her real significance and why she matters. You know, he, of course, rejects it and he says, I'm not the person I used to be. I can't do it. Find someone else. And then when Bail shows up, they have that conversation where Obi-Wan tells him, I can't leave the boy. And then Bail replies, this isn't about the boy and you know it. Mm-hmm. And I think that was a really interesting dimension because you're getting to see there how for Obi-Wan, being on Tatooine and looking after Luke is, on the one hand, it is the mission that he took on at the end of Revenge of the Sith. And it's important to him. Like, that's very clear. But also, we're getting to see in that episode how it's become this thing that he's kind of leaned on to avoid what his own internal issues and what's going on.
Right, yeah. I think the temptation there is very real to just literally stay in his cave and not face the problems that, you know, that... Not that he's created, but that he had played a role in. And so, yeah, I think that's why it was surprising to see Bail there. But I think there probably wasn't, for Obi-Wan, I can't see any other way that, yeah, he would have left Luke or his cave.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why like I really like the plot and them bringing in the Leia element. Because, yeah, if you want to do a show and the premise is, okay, we don't want to have it be 100% on Tatooine, we got to get him off it. What is the only thing, or who is the only thing that would cause Obi-Wan to break his exile? The only other person really is Leia. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as Bail said, that notion of, like, she's just as important as he is. I think it's just such an important thing to say that, yeah, that these twins are of equal value and of equal importance. So... You know, so we see Obi-Wan on the one hand, the way that he has kind of crafted this life for himself in the midst of the Empire and the way that he has tried to just kind of stay detached from the larger galaxy and the events that are happening, partly for very practical reasons in order to fulfill his mission to protect Luke, but then also because of this kind of inner struggle that he's dealing with and his own guilt and such. And then, of course, a big part of the show is watching him kind of overcome a lot of that. In terms of talking, you know, about another character and another example of how someone is dealing with the Empire, kind of responding to the presence of the Galactic Empire, I want to shift to episode 2 and talk about one Haja Estri.
He's great.
He's great. He's wonderful. Yeah. Played by Kumail Nanjiani. And I think like he's such an interesting character for a bunch of reasons. I mean, one is that he's one of the kind of comic reliefs of the show.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's there to give us this, the kind of lighter element in what is a very heavy, at times quite dark show. And I think another thing that's interesting about him is, again, it's going back to that idea of like other dimensions or seeing something from a different point of view, which is that on the one hand, being a Jedi in this time is, of course, very dangerous, as we see, you know, when the opening scene of the kind of present day of Obi-Wan Kenobi is the arrival of the Inquisitors on Tatooine. So we get to see just how dangerous it is to be someone who was once a Jedi. But then at the same time, what we get to see with Haja is like, oh, there's actually this also kind of cachet. There's a kind of like opportunity for self, you know, enrichment or aggrandizement by taking on the identity of a Jedi.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's just really interesting to see, like how he has kind of parlayed being a Jedi, like allegedly being a member from this kind of persecuted, lost group, and is using that to, and when we first meet him, kind of scam people out of their money.
But then in another twist, he actually is helping the Jedi. Yeah, yeah. So he's like got all these layers to him where you think he's just, you know, a con man, but he's really kind of more like a Jedi than you would think because he's risking himself to help others. I really like that about his character and the way that at first, you know, he's exactly what Obi-Wan was, you know, afraid of. He's another liar. He's another grifter. And then to see that, no, he's actually one of the good guys. I think that was a great twist to the character. A little bit like a Han Solo, right? You think he's a little bit of a scoundrel, but underneath it all, he's really a good guy. And I think that he and Haja are kindred spirits in that way.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, I would agree with that. And yeah, you know, as you pointed out, like, there is that for Obi-Wan, there is that kind of going on the journey of accepting that someone like a Haja is a, you know, is a valuable person, is someone who can do good, even if he's at times been kind of morally gray.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause of course, when he first meets him and confronts him and kind of exposes him as a scammer, you know, he has that line where he says, you're a bottom feeder, a rat who preys on weakness. So at first he's kind of completely dismissive of him. But then when Haja kind of proves himself, whether it is, you know, he helps Obi-Wan and Leia escape from Dayu, he distracts Reva, then there is that kind of growing of respect for him.
Right.
And I just love that exchange that they have in part 6 where, you know, Obi-Wan entrusts Haja with bringing Leia back to Alderaan, which in itself is very significant that he would do that. And then he has that, Haja has a line about like, I know the word of a liar and a fake Jedi may not mean much to you. And then Obi-Wan replies, it's good enough for me.
Yeah. Which is, and he's not even other than the force tricks, he's not even a liar. He does follow through on exactly what he offers, right? A chance to get away. So I think, I just think his character is interesting all around.
Yes. Yeah. I didn't put it in my notes, but I love that little thing that he has. It's towards the end of part 2 where he says like, do I help people? Yeah. Like, do I like credits? Sure. Like,
I mean, yes, he could be helping them out of the goodness of his heart without charging them. Absolutely. But
yes.
Like he says, he likes credits.
Yes. Yeah. It's really good. Yeah. So yeah, that idea of like taking this person who, you know, might be a little dubious, might be a little questionable, but then ultimately finding that they are of value and they can do good. Yeah, I think, as you point out, I think there is very much a through line from Obi-Wan growing to trust a Haja Estri all the way into A New Hope. And, you know, he's in that cantina with Han Solo and, you know, Luke is trying to say like, oh, this is like, we shouldn't go with this guy. This is ridiculous. Like, I can get my, like, I can buy my own ship. And Obi-Wan's like, hang on, kid.
Yeah.
I definitely think there is a through line there. Like, I think you can you can see how the experience with someone like Ahaja kind of informs Obi-Wan, saying, okay, like, I'll take a shot with this Han Solo guy, even though he's kind of like, he seems like a little cocky and everything, you know?
Yeah.
So you see kind of there, you know, with Haja, kind of another character and, you know, how he's kind of making do amidst the Galactic Empire, the way he's kind of set up this little kind of business for himself and has kind of cashed in on the Jedi mythos, if you will. And then the third character I want to talk about that we meet in the following episode, which is now everyone's new least favorite character in Star Wars. I'm referring, of course, to Freck.
Yeah. That guy.
Yes, yeah. Thoughts on Freck. Tell me about
him. He started out with like, well, that's a weird story. So, of course, at first I thought, oh, he's just, he's just going to help them out anyway out of the goodness of his heart, I guess. And then to see that the second Obi-Wan went around the back and he saw that Imperial flag on the back of the truck was just like, it was chilling almost, to be like, all of a sudden the danger factor felt like it went up by 100, because he was just an ordinary guy, and then all of a sudden you realize what side he's actually on and it becomes that much scarier. And the whole scene in the back with the stormtroopers and but for Freck, like, I think he pretty much just says, like, I like order. I just want, he just wants his normal orderly life. And I think that's a perspective we don't get too often in Star Wars, of living under the Empire.
Yeah, definitely. I would agree with you on that. Yeah, that he kind of embodies the Empire on the ground, like, mm-hmm. on the ground floor, where, we see, the part of the Empire that we're most familiar with and that we get the most exposure to as consumers of Star Wars is, whether that's the military side of it, stormtroopers, Star Destroyers, Death Stars, it is the Emperor, Vader, kind of all the big honchos of it. Mm-hmm. And of course, all of that is important to the Empire and kind of enforcing their rule across the galaxy and all that. But really, like, when you get to, like, what does the Empire need to kind of stay alive? It needs the Frecks.
Mm-hmm. And the stormtroopers, right? There's a reason why he switched from the clone troopers to, like, the locals. Like, those are guys that, and girls, I guess, that know each other. Like, Freck knew all those stormtroopers. So who's going to rise up against, the people that you see just doing their job every day? Like, it was a very, in terms of Palpatine planning ahead, I feel like that was a very calculated move on his part, moving from the clone troopers to stormtroopers who have a relationship with guys like Freck.
Yeah, that's a really good point. That's actually something I've never thought about before. But yeah, I think you're totally right about that. The move to the conscription model means that now the stormtroopers or the soldiers aren't just these creations from this lab in Kamino. They're now actually people they might be your son, daughter, they might be your dad, mm-hmm. whatever. And so, yeah, there is that kind of investment in the larger project that wouldn't be there otherwise if you just had this factory created army. And yeah, and then you kind of talked about, he's almost like the kind of photo negative of Haja, mm-hmm. where like you meet Haja first and you think like, oh, this is a kind of scammy guy, like he's not great, but then you find out, oh, he's actually like, he's the scoundrel with a heart of gold.
Yeah.
And then Freck is like, oh, like, here's this nice friendly truck driver guy. And then you find out like,
oh.
Yeah. Like, he's with the fascists.
Right.
Yeah. And yeah, you pointed out the iconography of the flag on the back of his truck, and then him picking up the stormtroopers, and then him like, he's going up to the checkpoint and saying like, oh, don't worry, like, I know these guys, no big deal. And then kind of going on saying like, these are kind of suspicious people that I picked up. You might want to check them out.
Yeah.
But yeah, he just kind of sells them out the first chance he gets.
Right. Like I said, it's not really a point of view we get very often, right? The guy who's not having, like, the guy who's not fighting a fight against the Empire, the guy who's just trying to live his ordinary life.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the person who is supportive of the Empire, not for some kind of, you know, personal goal or like self-aggrandizement or like wanting power or anything, but it's just right. This guy was like, oh, like they, you know, they make the trains run on time. They provide the order. Right. That's good enough for me. Yeah, no, that's definitely a perspective that we don't get a lot of in Star Wars. And I think it's an important one to get because, yeah, I think it's important to understanding the Empire. Like, you got to kind of see both sides of it. Like, you have to see, like, what's happening at the top, but then also the day-to-day regular people who are under its rule. Then, you know, in that same episode that we meet Freck in Part 3, we are also introduced to the character of Tala. And Tala is, I think, another one of these kind of archetypes of these characters who are, again, you know, living among within the Empire and their own journey and the way that they respond to the Imperial rule. Because what we learn about with Tala is that she was originally part of the Empire. She, like, she was a Freck at one point, pretty much. You know, she has a line where she says, "I joined up when the Empire stood for something." But then she has this kind of change of heart. And she says, "By the time I realized what they really were, it was too late." And so I think, and you can talk about this. I think the introduction of Tala and I think Obi-Wan meeting her and particularly learning about the path, I think is a really important kind of turning point in his story here.
No, I agree. I think she, first of all, I think when he said that the fight was over, he seriously believed that. He didn't think anybody else had survived. And then seeing that there are people, not only who are still alive, like Quinlan, who he name drops, but that there are people who are fighting for the Jedi, like Tala and the rest of the path. I think, like you said, that's a big turning point. I think she's there to show him that you don't have to keep looking backward at what happened. You can start moving forward and fighting again. And I don't think he had that point of view until he met her.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, because really, I mean, as far as we know, she's the first resistance type figure that he ever meets of anybody who is actively in some way fighting back against the Empire.
Right.
And so when he meets her and then when he learns about the path, I think that's really important to shifting his notion about the fight. Because as you point out, like, yeah, he initially says the fight is done, we lost. You know, here he starts to see, oh, actually, there is still a fight that's going on. And people are involved and people are taking risks every day. You know, the revelation about Quinlan Voss being on the path, like just even that way that, you know, he's looking at the inscriptions and he kind of lights up when he reads Quinlan's name.
Yeah, it's like the first time he's hopeful at all in the series.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, when he realizes that, oh, this guy that he knew at one point earlier in his life is both A, alive, and B, he's part of this, helping ferrying people along. And so that notion of, oh, there is still work to be done. There is still a fight to be fought. And I think that's really important in terms of getting him away from where we see him in part one at the very beginning. And I think the other thing that it really comes to the fore when he meets Tala and he learns about the path in part three, I think, is that revelation about that the Empire is hunting not just Jedi, but all Force sensitives. Because I think that's genuinely, I think what you get from that scene is that is something that Obi-Wan did not know.
Right. And I think, I don't know how much they go into it, and I can't quite remember, but I believe that what they're doing is they're either, I think when a Jedi or Force sensitive is captured, they're either given the choice to join as an Inquisitor or they face death, which I think is pretty sinister. And I think they kind of hint at that when they have him, Obi-Wan, in the fortress depths, which we hadn't seen before.
Because back at the beginning of the show, when he meets Nari, you know, the advice about where he gives him and he tells him, you know, just bury your lightsaber, keep your head down, just live an ordinary life. I think at this moment, when he learns this from Tala about the fact that the Empire actually has this very, very wide scope of hunting anybody who has any kind of force abilities or force predilections, and then combined with, as you pointed out in part four, when he's in the Fortress Inquisitorius and then he goes and he sees the tomb, I think both of those have this effect for Obi-Wan where it clicks and they say, oh, like, that's not good enough.
Right.
Yeah, the strategy of just keep your head down, like, so long as you don't appear as a Jedi or people don't think you're a Jedi, you're going to be okay. It's like, oh no, this is much more sweeping. This is much broader than what he had in mind.
Right. And the fight's not done.
Yes. And the realization that if that's the case, then even someone like a Leia or like a Luke, just by virtue of having some sort of force abilities, they're immediately going to be in danger. Yeah, so I think, yeah, that meeting Tala and getting to see this person who had this kind of change of heart, and, you know, as you pointed out also, like, is someone who teaches Obi-Wan about how, like, just because you did certain things wrong in the past, or there are some regrets or mistakes that you had, like, just dwelling on that is not an option. Like, there has to be a kind of moving forward and looking ahead.
Right.
And that's something that Tala does. And it was something we'll kind of talk about in the kind of next chunk of the conversation, because I think there's a lot in this show about this kind of duality of, like, the past and the future. And mm-hmm. So, yeah. So I think she's a really important figure in that way in getting Obi-Wan to start to see, like, okay, I don't have to necessarily spend my life fixating on what went wrong with Anakin and all of that. I can start to look ahead to what I can potentially do and what I can potentially offer. Mm-hmm. And so the final character that I want to look at in kind of this context of the conversation about the Empire and responding to the Empire is the character of Roken,
mm-hmm.
who is just a character I really, really love him.
He's great.
Yes. Yeah. You know, portrayed by O'Shea Jackson Jr., I think done really, really well. He's in a way, like, for me, he's like the rebellion version of Freck, which is the, like, mm-hmm. he is the kind of rebellion everyman.
Yeah. He reminds me a lot. I don't know if you played Battlefront 2, but he reminds me a lot of Shriv. Because they're just like, they're the normal guys, right? They're just the regular, ordinary people. They're not Jedi. They're not, you know, officers. They're not swinging around in there. Well, I guess Shriv does have an X-Wing later or something, but they're just the normal, everyday guys who are risking everything to help people. And I feel like in some ways they're the bravest of all, because they're doing it because they know it's right, not because they know they'll win, if that makes sense. Like,
yeah.
That's why they're compelling, is because they are just like us, like just regular people who are just risking everything to do the right thing.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I love the comparison to Shriv. Like, that's a really good one, because, yeah, I think there is that similarity of just the regular person, the boots on the ground.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the same way that, you know, as you talked about with Freck, that, like, the Empire needs the Frecks to survive. Something like the Rebellion needs the Rokens.
Exactly.
It needs the regular guys who are just like, I want to help out these people and do what I can. And so, yeah, I think that's why that's exactly why he's compelling. As you said, like we can imagine ourselves as a Roken. It's hard to imagine yourself as a, you know, a Jedi or a senator or something like that. But
right.
You can see yourself just being this guy who was married to someone who got taken away by the Inquisitors, and now you're trying to help out other people who are in similar danger. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, like he's a character I really like. I love that exchange that he has with Obi-Wan at the end in part six, when he's kind of laying out his plan about where he's going to kind of leaving the escape pod in order to distract Vader. And then Obi-Wan tells him, like, there are not a lot of leaders. Like, people listen to you. Like, you're important. And he has that line, like, I'm just getting started.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think that is such a great, like, point B from the point A where we start. Like, at the beginning of the show, you got Obi-Wan saying, like, the fight is done. We lost. It's over. And then you got Roken at the end saying, like, no, we're just getting started.
Right. It's all about the hope. And you can tell that Roken definitely has hope. It's almost kind of like a confidence to the way he says that I think, you know, at first when he met Obi-Wan, I think he was pretty resistant to the idea. And then by the time, you know, he's got everybody on board and he hears Obi-Wan's speech about this is the future, I think that has an impact on him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And yeah, I think that's another... That's an important moment of where you get to see how Obi-Wan's perspective has started to shift over the course of this journey, where at the beginning of the show, he's really kind of fixated and grounded in the past and what was lost and his relationship with Anakin and how all that fell apart. And then by the end, he's looking to the future and talking about the future,
mm-hmm.
which is a really good transition to getting into the second half of our conversation, which is about the binary of past and future in this show. Because I think there's a lot of characters who are kind of grappling with that of kind of, on the one hand, like who they were or what they did, who they are now, and then, you know, looking into the future and what's to come.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, we can start, of course, by, again, kind of circling back to the character of Obi-Wan, where when we see him in the beginning of the show, he's kind of trapped in this middle space where he's, on the one hand, he's looking to the future. He's kind of got an eye on the future with respect to Luke.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of see that in the conversation with Owen when Owen brings him back the toy Skyhopper. And, you know, he talks about, like, when the time comes, he has to be trained. And then you get the, you know, the clap back that everybody talked about in the trailer. Yes. Yeah, the, like you trained his father. And then Obi-Wan just immediately, like, you see it on his face when the camera cuts. Like, he has no response.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, I think you can see that, like, the kind of tension that he's in that moment where, like, He's trying to be hopeful, like he's got a lot invested in this kid Luke, and he wants to train him, but then it's like, oh yeah, like what happened with Anakin and all that, and that's the thing that's holding him back,
right? Because he is sort of still following the past and how the Jedi did things, I think, at that point. And I think, you know, we all love the Obi-Wan's hello there's and good jobs, and he has all the little quips, but when Owen uses that truth against him, like he has nothing because he knows that he's right. Like he has no response. And so I think that scene sets up like a little bit of where the guilt is coming from and a little bit of where Obi-Wan might, you know, be clinging to how they, you know, exactly what happened with Anakin with training him. And then by the end, we see he changes his mind on that.
Yes. Yeah. And you know, we'll talk about that because I think that's a really kind of important evolution for him and how he kind of looks at Luke.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like that whole notion of the past and what happened, like that kind of comes back up again when Obi-Wan is about to take on the mission to go save Leia. And, you know, Bail comes to him in person and tries to persuade him to do it. And he has that whole line where he says, you've made mistakes. We all did. It's the past. Move on. Be done with
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got Bail there, you know, very clearly trying to say, like, look, all that happened. Yes, it was bad. But, like, you got to kind of just silo that. And you got to look ahead.
Right. And we haven't even talked about Reva yet, but I feel like she mm-hmm. is another person who's very stuck in the past and what happened in the temple. And I think later it's in a bit of a circle when it's Obi-Wan telling her the same thing that Bail told him, which is, you know, the past is done. Now you have a chance to be free and move forward. It's a good, it's a nice echo of the first episode.
Yes, exactly. And yeah, fear not, we will talk about Reva because yeah, there's a lot on this theme about past and the future and all that. I think there is a lot to talk about in the context of Reva. And I think once Obi-Wan is actually on the main mission, like, I think that notion of the past, and particularly like past and present, I think comes a lot into play in his time with Leia and in a lot of the interactions and conversations that he and Leia have, which, like, I think we can, like this might be a good point to kind of like stop and just kind of like a sidebar and just to say, like, the casting of Vivian Leigh Blair as Leia is just phenomenal.
Yeah, she's fantastic.
She really is. Like, it is, you know, we did not see it coming in terms of having young Leia being like the central, like one of the main characters of the show, and it not being Luke. And yeah, I don't think they could have done better. Like, she is just, she channels so much of Leia's own personality and energy from the very beginning. And there is just such a through line from there to Carrie Fisher Leia.
Mm-hmm. I think it shows too. I remember George Lucas had a quote once that Leia is the one who always knows what's going on. She's like the smart one. And in a lot of ways, she's the hero of the story. And she's been involved with the rebellion since, you know, almost since she was born because of Bail and Brea. And, you know, this adventure ties it in. We see her in Rebels when she's a teenager. She's already part of the rebellion. And I think having her be the center of the story makes her path make a lot of sense, and just once again emphasizes how it's always been Leia that keeps up the fight from the, you know, beginning to the very end.
Yeah. And that's really to kind of like step even outside of Obi-Wan Kenobi the show to kind of take a broader look at, like, particularly the Disney era of Star Wars. I think this is something that I've really, really appreciated about what we've had in the kind of, well, it's this fall, I think, will be 10 years since Disney acquired Lucasfilm. Like the kind of elevation of Leia and the significance placed on her as really being, like, as Obi-Wan and Yoda have the exchange in Empire Strikes Back about that boy is our last hope, no, there is another. Mm-hmm. Like, I think one of the things that the Disney era of Star Wars has done very, very well is really, like, making that line ring true.
Mm-hmm.
And saying that she really is the second hope. And really elevating her to equal footing with Luke. And that's something that I've really, really liked. And I think this show fits squarely within that.
Mm-hmm. It shows, you know, the influence that Obi-Wan had on both of them. Obviously her parents who encourage her to lead her own way, and to the way at the end when they just embraced the, like, little holster on her hip, like, parenting goals right there. Like, yes. I'm gonna always keep, as a parent, I'm always gonna keep their attitudes in mind. Like, they didn't blink, they didn't say, are you sure? They just said, cool, let's go.
Yes, yeah, getting to, yeah, that's another one of the treats of this show is, yeah, getting to see some of those Leia, Brea, Bail moments and interactions, mm-hmm. whether it is, yeah, like Brea trying to, like, get Leia back into line and to listen, and Leia disobeying her, or that whole conversation on the balcony between Bail and Leia, mm-hmm. about, I'm not even a real Organa, and all of that, like, those kind of tender moments, I think, are just phenomenal.
Okay.
As I sort of started talking about before, like, one of the things that starts coming through as Obi-Wan and Leia start, like, spend a lot of time and have these moments where they start getting to talk to one another is you're getting to see Obi-Wan kind of calling back to the past and kind of bringing up these moments or these people from the past in the context of Leia. Like, there's that whole conversation in part two when they're leaving Dayu and he makes the remark about, you remind me of someone.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I remember one of the things that, like, happened after that episode came out, after technically both of those episodes came out, is people talking about, like, oh, like, is he talking about Padme? Like, is it a Padme reference? Is it a Satine reference? Like, what's he talking about? Because of that general language about, like, oh, she was a leader. She passed away a long time ago. She was, I don't remember exactly what it was, like, fearless, determined, stubborn, etc. And I think, like, I think one of the things that I like about that line and the way that it was worded and set up in that way, like, is that I think there is a certain, I think there is room for a certain amount of, like, from a certain point of view,
mm-hmm.
where, like, you can say, like, yeah, he is talking about Padme, or he is talking about Satine, or he's talking about both.
Right.
I think there's enough space in there to kind of play with it and to kind of, like, bring your own Star Wars knowledge to bear.
Mm-hmm. So I was, like, always hoping for a Satine reference in there.
Yes. Yeah. You and a lot of people were hoping for it. Yeah. So, you know, you get that, and then you get the conversation in the following episode when they're on the back of Freck's truck, where you have once again the bringing up of Padme in a very kind of tender way, when, you know, when they're talking to the stormtroopers about, like, oh, we came here because this is where I met her mother, and, like, she passed away, we miss her very much.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Obi-Wan kind of talking about his own family and about how he thought, like, he had a younger brother. And so, like, you're getting to see kind of Obi-Wan opening up in that way and, you know, being more vulnerable and being willing to kind of actually talk more about the past and engage with it. Whereas kind of at the beginning of the show, you could see he was kind of trying to, like, keep it at a distance, run away from it.
Mm-hmm. I really appreciated that he didn't just think of Anakin, which I think would have been a natural assumption. But that conversation shows that, you know, he has regrets about Padme and considered her a close friend as well. And I don't know, without Leia, if we would have gotten that kind of insight into Obi-Wan.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And then, yeah, that I think really comes to kind of full fruition in part six, when they have that moment on Alderaan on the landing platform, mm-hmm. where he kind of talks to her and he talks about how, like, oh, you've got these traits that are from your mother, and you've got these other traits, and those come from your father. And so, yeah, that kind of, again, in the same way that you sort of talked about a few minutes ago about putting Luke and Leia on kind of equal footing, they're kind of putting Anakin and Padme on equal footing in terms of saying, mm-hmm. like, these children are elements of both of these people. I think that was a really, really wonderful and tender moment there at the end, when he's mm-hmm. kind of telling Leia about her birth parents without telling her about her birth parents, essentially.
Right. And the way she looked at Bail and Bray, like, no, I'm good. That's good now. That's all I needed to know.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, exactly. And that in itself is, like, another kind of testimony about, like, just, like, the place that Bail and Brea have in terms of, like, being mm-hmm. Leia's parents and the ones who raised her, where she says, like, you know, like, that's enough. Like, I don't need to know more. Like, I've got these two.
She's accepted that she is an Organa, I think, at that point.
Yes. Yeah. That's a very good point. Yes. Yeah. She's moved from, you know, taking her cousin's burn to heart to saying, like, no, this is my family.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, we get into, you know, we've talked about, like, Obi-Wan and all of that. And then I think this element of, again, the past and the future and all that, I think also comes into play with some of our antagonists for the show. And that's particularly Darth Vader and Reva. And so, you know, I mentioned at the top of the show, like, the main reason, like, the kind of big reason that I asked you on for this conversation is because of your connection to Obi-Wan, and you wrote this book and you have that kind of background. The other reason that I also wanted you to have you on for this conversation is that you, like me, are a fellow Darth Vader simp.
He's my favorite.
Yes, he is also my favorite. I am in the office in which I am doing this recording. I am surrounded by Vader things. Like, they're all on the shelves. Like, he is, has been, and will always be my favorite Star Wars character. My first Star Wars memory is watching A New Hope and seeing him come onto the Tantive IV. Mm-hmm. Like, that's the first, like, burned in memory that I have of anything Star Wars. And so getting him back, just to kind of, even, you know, just stepping back from, like, any kind of thematic deep stuff before getting into that, like, just getting him, not only just having him back in the show, but then also the way that he is he is portrayed in the show is just so good.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
Yeah, it is everything that I could have asked for as someone who has loved this character for many, many years.
I know we've been treated to so many good Vader stories in the comics. I was so happy to finally see him get that same kind of close-up in this series.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. And, you know, we've already kind of touched a little bit on Reva, but we can, of course, get into more of it here. I think both of those characters, both Vader and Reva, represent these sort of specters of the past in their own ways, where, like, on the one hand, you've got Vader, who embodies Obi-Wan's loss of Anakin and everything that went wrong there. And then you've got Reva on the other hand, and she is the kind of embodiment of the shadow of Order 66.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we get, you know, with Vader, you know, we get that moment at the end of part two where you get the revelation to Obi-Wan that Anakin is still alive. That, you know, he thought he had left him for dead, and then it turns out he was still around. And also that, just that great revelation. I remember that, like, even just, like, you know, not being in the stage, but just, like, watching the hotel room, that kind of, like, head-spinning moment where she says, Anakin Skywalker is alive, and you're like, what?
Yeah.
Excuse me? Like, you know that name?
Yeah, it's like, well, how are you alive if you know that name? That's what I thought.
Yeah. Like, that was just such a wild moment when that happened. And then, yeah, getting to see, like Obi-Wan's reaction to that news, to that realization. And, like, that great shot that the episode ends on when he's, like, on the ship and he's kind of trying to process it. And he says, Anakin. And then you get the cutaway to Hayden in the back tank.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, like, that is a really important moment. I mean, of, you know, for one, for the obvious reason of Obi-Wan realizing, oh, that his, you know, his former friend and brother who he thought he left for dead is still around. But it's also this moment where Obi-Wan realizes that in some ways he can't really follow Bail's advice from part one, where Bail tells him in the comics of taking the mission, like, okay, be done with the past, forget about it. And now it's like, oh no, he's still around.
Yeah.
Like, you have to deal with what happened.
Right. And I think that was something, you know, probably not many of us had thought about before, was that Obi-Wan had spent 10 years thinking that he had killed Anakin. I don't know why. It never occurred to me that he didn't realize that Anakin was still alive. And as soon as that became apparent, it just made my heart break for him, for Obi-Wan.
Yeah, that's a good point. Actually, you bring up something important there about, like not realizing that Obi-Wan didn't realize Anakin was still alive. Because, yeah, because I always think about, like, there was some, I don't remember how long ago it was, but, like, you know, of course, there's the moment at the end of Revenge of the Sith where, you know, Padme is dying, and then in her dying breath, she tells Obi-Wan, there's good in him, I know there's still. And so, like, you watch that, and the assumption is, okay, like, everybody kind of believes he's still alive.
Right.
Because, of course, Padme believes he's still alive. But now you look back and you think, like, oh, wait, Obi-Wan doesn't think he's alive?
Yeah.
Like, so it's like, oh, does he just think, like, oh, Padme, like, you have no clue. You know, it's like, oh, okay. Yeah, I had one of those moments, like, it wasn't in watching the show, like, it was sometime before. I was like, oh, wait, hang on. Like, what's everybody's assumption here?
Right. Yeah, because he's so utterly unsurprised to see him in A New Hope, right? So I'd always assumed he knew he was alive and Darth Vader, but then just... And then when he realized he thought that he had killed Anakin, it's just... Ugh. It's yeah. So good.
And so, yeah, like, the, you know, the reunion that happens in part three between the two of them, like, that, there's that great exchange about what have you become? I am what you made me. It's mm-hmm. like, you know, Obi-Wan having to, you know, confront what he did to Anakin and what Anakin has now become as a result of that, or what he is now. And yeah, like, that really, like, that whole experience really forcing Obi-Wan to now have to, you know, not walk away from the past, not run away from it, but in some ways kind of still deal with it. You know, there's that line from Tala in part 5 where she tells him, like, some things can't be forgotten.
Right.
And so, like, Obi-Wan is kind of in this place of, like, okay, now there has to be some sort of dealing with what happened.
Right, which is a very, I'm going to say it's a very Obi-Wan thing to do. Like, I don't feel like he ever was the type to hide from his problems. He always, you know, he jumped in and said hello there to Grievous. Like, he's yes. he's not originally the kind of person who would, you know, just hide in his cave all the time. And so I think maybe seeing Anakin alive is that, or hearing that Anakin is alive is that, like, that spark to kind of, like, I think he probably knows in that moment that he is going to have to confront the past.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that all really kind of comes to a fore for the two of them in the duel in part 6, mm-hmm. which is just like, if that really, I think that lived up to Rematch of the Century to the hype that we got. Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah. I mean, it was so good from both a fight choreography standpoint, from like that visual element. You know, we got a high ground nod without getting a high ground nod.
Right.
Vader buries him in the rocks. And then just from also the emotions of it all, from Obi-Wan breaking the suit, breaking open the mask, and like just that, like that line when Obi-Wan looks into the mask and he sees Anakin, you know, when he says his name and then he replies, "Anakin is gone, I am what remains."
Mm-hmm.
Like that is one of the most just like viscerally chilling Darth Vader lines.
Yes, the "I am what you made me" and "I am what remains" like instantly iconic Darth Vader lines.
Yeah, and I mean, of course, you know, the comparison can be made between, on the one hand, like this scene and then what we get in Twilight of the Apprentice and Rebels with, you know, the cracking of the mask and then, you know, Obi-Wan and Ahsoka respectively kind of seeing Anakin through the mask. But I think tonally, these scenes are very, very different.
No, I agree. Yeah.
Yeah, because the Ahsoka one, like, it has this kind of, this sort of like tragic element where she's sort of reaching out to Anakin, you know, she's telling him, "I won't leave you." And you kind of see that Anakin for like a hot second thinks about it,
mm-hmm.
but then doubles down. Versus the scene that we get at the end of Obi-Wan is dark, it is macabre, it's very unsettling.
Yeah, that little smile on Hayden's face, that whole scene.
Yeah, that part when he says, you know, "You didn't kill Anakin Skywalker, I did." Yeah, he has that like almost feral look in his face.
But that, so I have literally been thinking about that scene like every day for the past week.
Insane.
And I keep going back and forth on whether he's being Anakin in that moment and showing him compassion by releasing him from his guilt, or if he's pretty much just being Darth Vader bragging that he killed Anakin and power of the dark side is supreme. Like I go back and forth on whether he's showing him compassion or not in that moment. But that little smile kind of makes me, is it always the reason why I don't know.
You know, I think that's a really good point. Like, I think you're absolutely right that is a scene that, like, sort of like the Padme Satine of it all that I mentioned a few minutes ago. Like, I think that is a moment there where, you know, when Obi-Wan basically says, "I'm sorry for all of it," and then Vader replies, "I'm not your failure. You didn't kill Anakin Skywalker. I did." Mm-hmm. I think that is very much a kind of, again, where you can do the kind of certain point of view of it all, of like what exactly is happening there. Like, I think both of those interpretations are valid. Of, you can say that on the one hand, like, maybe this is a little bit of Anakin breaking through and trying to remove some of the guilt that his former master has been carrying around.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's, I think, also the other interpretation of, oh, this is the kind of classic dark sider of saying like, no, like, I'm not going to admit that you did anything. I want to take responsibility for all of this.
Right. I wasn't being weak. I was being strong and killing Anakin myself.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think both of those are valid ways to read that. And so, yeah, that whole, and just all, just even like the visuals, the like the sound work that they do when it like it's mixing in both the Hayden Christensen and the,
oh,
the
so James. Good.
Yeah. And it's kind of like going back and forth between them. Like it's so chilling.
Yeah. I think it's where he says Obi-Wan that it mixes back to Vader. Mm-hmm. And it's just so good.
Yes. Yeah. And I think like, that's a moment where like once Vader says that to him about you didn't kill Anakin Skywalker, I did. Like, I think that is a moment where Obi-Wan at that point kind of accepts pretty much that Anakin has kind of made his bed and is laying in it.
Yeah.
And because he has that like the goodbye Darth, which I really love.
I love what he says, Darth. I totally decided he's being snarky, like, okay, yep. Darth.
Yeah, yeah, I totally agree with you that. I think that is 100% snark. That is him throwing Anakin's decision back in his face.
Yeah.
Although, I think as ultimately, you know, as we see once we get into the original trilogy and Return of the Jedi, Obi-Wan, on the one hand, kind of accepts, okay, this is what Anakin has chosen, what he's done. But ultimately, as we see, he wrongly believes that Anakin can't undo the choice.
Mm-hmm.
Because that is ultimately, you know, what he tries to tell Luke about. Like, he's more machine now, the man twisted and evil, and you got to kill him. And then it's Luke who realizes, no, there's an alternative.
Right. Which also kind of echoes Yoda and Ben trying to tell him not to go on Empire, and that actually he actually did the right thing by going. Yeah, they're not always right.
Yeah. And I think, you know, to kind of wrap up the Vader of it all in this context, and then we'll kind of circle back to Reva, is, you know, I think that this theme of the past and the future, I think, also comes back into the last scene that we get with Vader, which is his conversation with the Emperor.
Mm-hmm.
Which has one of my picks, and it's not the only one for this show, of like a great unintentionally funny moment in this show, which is, you know, how like it cuts to the interior of the Mustafar castle and you've got Vader saying like, we've sent all the probes, we're searching every system, we're going to destroy everything. And then there's just that like a couple of second, like too long pause from the Emperor.
He's like, I got your number.
Like, I don't know if that was a directing choice or what, like it just works so funny because it's like, it's Palpatine being like, you did what now?
Yeah.
It's really, really good. And then, yeah, his actual, like, you seem agitated.
Yeah.
I love it. It's so good. And, and then, you know, Palpatine bringing up the fact about, like, oh, like, you know, you're really obsessed with your former master. And, like, if your past can't be overcome. And then that's when Vader does the kind of, like, the backpedals.
Yeah.
And backs off, and then, you know, so it's like, I serve only you, like, he means nothing. And then, you know, we get Vader kind of, you know, just doubling down there.
Right.
The other, you know, I mentioned this is an unintentionally funny moment. The other unintentionally funny moment for me in the show was, and this is a moment that, like, when it happened, when I first watching it, I straight burst out laughing when it happened. It is in part 4, and it is the scene where it's towards the end when Tala and Obi-Wan and Leia, they escape on the speeders, and you get that shot from behind of Reva looking out from the hangar, and then it does the smash cut to Vader.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I actually, like, it was a laugh out loud moment because it's just so funny. It goes from that and then him like storming down the hall.
Oh gosh, yeah, or he means business. Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
It was so good.
He was mad, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, the big mad Darth Vader moment. Like, I love that.
Yeah, that was good.
And so, yeah, so you see, you know, you see the way that Vader as this character is also kind of struggling with the past, like with who he was and who he is now and what he's kind of committed to, and the way this confrontation with Obi-Wan brings it out. And then, of course, the other character to talk about in this context of like the past and so on is Reva. Because, you know, Vader kind of highlights what went wrong with Anakin at a kind of personal level between him and Obi-Wan and this relationship. And then Reva, is the person who kind of brings out this kind of larger collapse of the Jedi and all of those consequences. Mm-hmm. The things that kind of the kind of ripple effect from the dissolution of this brotherhood. And I think she's a great character just all throughout the show. Like, I think, you know, from a kind of acting perspective, Moses Ingram just did a phenomenal job in that role. Mm-hmm. And
especially if you go back knowing what you know.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Where you get to see those shades of why she is the way she is when she has that moment, for example, on Tatooine, when she's talking about like how the Jedi are cowards, they won't help you, they're not coming, and all of that. Mm-hmm. And you see where that's coming from. And you have that conversation in part five between Reva and Obi-Wan behind the doors, where, you know, she's telling him about how she was at the temple when Anakin came in and they were killing everyone. And she has the line where she talks about how, like, where were you while he was killing my friends? He was your Padawan. Why didn't you stop him? Why didn't you save us?
Mm-hmm. Which is probably the same thing Obi-Wan's been thinking for the last 10 years.
Yeah, exactly. And it is like, much like with like let's say an Owen or something like that, like it is one of those moments of like, from a certain point of view where like, you know, we as like the Star Wars fans watching, because they're like, well, you know, he was on Utapau fighting General Grievous. Like, and like, we can give the kind of objectively correct answer, quote unquote. Right. But like from Reva's point of view, it is like, hey, like you trained this guy and then he murdered all of my friends. Like, right. Why weren't you there to stop him? Like that's her truth. And she's not necessarily wrong.
Right. And again, he doesn't have that. A comeback or an answer at that point, either.
Yeah, in the same way that Owen isn't necessarily wrong when he's like, well, right. I don't want you to train Luke. Look what you did with his father. Look how that went. And yeah, like he, like him not having a kind of response to that. And then, you know, we get to see, you know, Reva, like the way that she's kind of caught in this limbo of who she is now and like what happened in the past, like that fight that happens at the end of part five with mm-hmm. Vader when she duels him, just that like that ice cold moment when he calls her youngling.
Mm-hmm. That he knew all along.
Yeah, that he knew not just what her scheme was, but he knew who she was. Mm-hmm. And that he remembered her, like that moment. And then, you know, in part six, when she goes to Tatooine, to the homestead, to kind of kill Luke, because she has this feeling of like, this is how she's going to avenge her friends that were murdered by Anakin, and then ultimately stopping herself.
Yeah, I'm really glad that she didn't die at the end of the series. I can't think of a nicer way to say it.
Yes.
I'm very happy that, you know, in Star Wars, many times the redemption ends in a person's, you know, passing away, like Vader. And so with Reva, you know, looking, now that she has moved on from her past and looking to her future, like I can't help that, or help thinking that that story will be told. And I kind of really hope it'll be in like a Jedi Fallen Order type situation. Like I mm-hmm. would love to see maybe her story meet up with Cal. I mean, there's always like, you know, there's books and comic books that we're so lucky that we get for telling these stories we might not see otherwise. And I really hope that we get to see hers in one of those mediums.
Yeah, definitely. I'm 100% with you there. Like that was, when we were going into the finale, I was, of course, hyped for it because like it was going to be the resolution of the show and like we were going to get another Obi-Wan Vader showdown. The part of it where I was like holding my breath it was Reva. It's like I wanted to survive. I wanted to come out of this. Like I think mm-hmm. there's so much, as you said, I think there's so much storytelling potential with her and directions that she could go, and like maybe she ends up on the path, maybe she does something else, we don't know. And so yeah, like throughout like a big chunk of my first watch of part six, I'm like, oh god, like don't let it, like don't do it, don't do it, don't mm-hmm. do it.
Well, and like I said earlier, anybody who knows that Vader's Anakin, they don't live long.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I really did not expect her to make it out of there.
Yeah, definitely. Like, so it was very easy just from part two to kind of mark her for dead.
Yeah.
Once you find that out. And so, yeah, when you get that moment of she chases Luke into the canyon and she's going to go in for the kill, but then she sees herself there. And like, I think that there's so many kind of parallels and nods, I think, there to the end of Return of the Jedi, where, you know, Luke chops off the Vader hand and he's about to go in for the kill, but then he sees his own robot hand and he mm-hmm. sees his dad's robot hand, and it's like, oh shoot, like I'm becoming him.
Right.
And that being the thing that stops her ultimately, and stops Luke in that context of Jedi. And yeah, you know, you kind of talked about this earlier on, but yeah, that conversation that Obi-Wan and Reva have at the end, where Reva is questioning her decision to spare Luke, and she says, have I failed them? Has she let down her friends? And you know, he says, you haven't failed them. You've given them peace. And you know, she asks him, have I become him? No, you have chosen not to.
Mm-hmm.
And like, that's just, that's a wonderful encapsulation. Just like, a big thing of Star Wars, which is that notion of breaking the cycle.
Right. And it's the opposite of what Anakin says during their duel, that, you know, you never win a battle with mercy, I think is what he says.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And she did win. I mean, that is how she honored them. And that is how she, in a way, won her freedom from the past.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, you brought up that notion where he says, like, well, like what you become, like you're free now, what you become is up to you. So yeah, again, that idea of that shift for Obi-Wan of moving away from being rooted and stuck in the past and dwelling in the past, now saying, okay, well, look ahead mm-hmm. to what you could become.
Which is, and that's why he says, I'm free too. Which is
yes. yes. Yeah. Because he's kind of freed himself of a lot of the guilt around Anakin.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, he can sort of move forward. And, you know, you kind of talked about like how like his shift with how he looks at Luke, where kind of at the beginning of it. And I think this is a lot of ways that like probably Owen kind of interpreted what Obi-Wan was doing, was like he probably saw that Obi-Wan saw Luke as this kind of tool.
Right.
As this thing to be trained to then be used later on. And then Obi-Wan getting to this moment at the end saying like, you know what, he does just need to be a boy. And just grow up and live a normal life. Yeah. And that, I don't remember the exact line, but something about like the future will sort itself out or something like mm-hmm. that. And that was actually like, if you had me like pick like what was like among the kind of biggest surprises from this show, I think the tender Owen moment there would be, if not the top, then pretty high.
Mm-hmm.
Because like that genuinely surprised me that like you want to meet him.
I know you can see he doesn't want to quite say it, but then he says it.
Yes, yeah. Because my sort of assumption was that they were going to end on like they don't end on great terms. They're not friends by any stretch.
Right.
But like particularly after the whole Reva situation, like my assumption was pretty much that like they were going to end with Owen being like, "Get out of here! Like I don't want to see you. Like, go away." Leave us alone. Mm-hmm. But then, yeah, having that moment where he's like, oh, like, go meet him. Go say hi. I think it was a nice little moment.
No, I agree. And I feel like in A New Hope, you get the feeling that they know each other. So I thought that was a nice little, like, nod to how maybe that they might not have had, like, a close relationship, but maybe that's how their friendship started. Luke and yes. Obi-Wan.
Yeah. 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 That's a good point. Yeah. Where he's like, where you're having like, I think he might have met old Ben. Like he talks about he was owned by Obi-Wan Kenobi. Like, was it that guy? Like, yeah. And so you see somebody like, oh, okay. Like, that's why Luke would kind of know who this guy is mm-hmm. or have some vague idea. So, yeah, I totally agree with you on that. So to kind of wrap up the kind of discussion of the show overall, to kind of put a bow on things, I wanted to get your picks for a couple different favorites from the show.
Okay.
Get your opinion. So first one is favorite part or like slash favorite episode.
I have watched the part six more than any other. So probably that one for the confrontation between Vader and Obi-Wan.
All right. Yep. That's a good one. I think it's hard not to pick six because there's so much good emotional weighty stuff. I think personally, I'm still going to lean to part three. I like just part three just has some really good stuff. Like all of the particular, like the kind of introduction to Vader into the show, him showing up and just wrecking shop through the village and all of that. Yeah, like that was just very dark stuff in that episode there where he's just like force choking the villagers and all that.
Yeah.
And I remember like I had the thought at that time, but then also like after part four, when we get into the fortress and we see the tomb, like I remember there was that from one interview or another, maybe it was like Entertainment Weekly or another, where they were like talking about how, like, oh, this show was darker and we had to kind of lighten it up. And I'm thinking, like, that was the point where I was like, what was the darker version of the show?
This is pretty dark.
Yeah, like this is pretty dark. Like, what were we gonna get?
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm gonna go with part three as my favorite part. It is kind of, it's harder to talk about this show in its chunks because they flow so smoothly as opposed to like, let's say a Mando or Book of Boba Fett. But yeah, I think to the extent that you can think of them as kind of discrete parts, I think I'm going to go with part three. But yeah, part six is hard not to choose. All right. Favorite new character that we meet in the show.
Oh, I want to say Lola. Sorry, Reva. Sorry, Tal.
I like that. Lola is a great character. I like, you know, who doesn't love a droid, you know?
Yeah.
Like, who doesn't love a helpful droid? I like that, you know, I like that, you know, Leia didn't have to give her like the old Yeller treatment when she went evil.
Yeah, she's just like, oh, I can fix this. Yeah,
yeah. She just sees the little tracker, pulls it off, and like, okay, you're good.
Yeah, I just like the idea of Leia's little best friend and the only witness to the greatest confrontation ever.
Well, I didn't think about that, but that's totally right.
That's right. She's the only one who saw it.
Yeah, she's the only one who knows. She's the only witness. That's a really good point. I never thought about that. I think. For my pick for favorite new character, I think I'm going to have to go with Reva. I think from the point of view of her motivations and her character, I think that's pretty unique. Like even if you just look, let's say, among the Inquisitors themselves, in terms of like why they're going along with this, that she has this kind of motivation that like she's there, but like really she's not serving Vader. She's hunting him. She's trying to get back at him for what he did. Like, that's really unique. And I think she's like even more broadly among kind of villains in Star Wars or Darksiders. I think she kind of stands out in that way. And then also, yeah, now that she's safely alive at the end of the show, I think the potential for her moving forward. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think the series might end up being more of a origin story for her than we realized.
Yeah, no, I agree. Definitely. And last favorite is favorite quote or line of dialogue or exchange.
So like I said, I was thinking about the you didn't kill Anakin line all week, but I think my favorite was Qui-Gon's. Well, it took you long enough at the end because it was just so quintessentially Qui-Gon, and Obi-Wan is just so delighted to see him, like, and the whole hopeful note and, you know, them going off to their next path, you know, part of the journey together. Like, I think that was my favorite because you knew it was going to happen from the very first episode, because you knew that Obi-Wan had been calling to him. So Obi-Wan is not surprised to see him at the end. He's just more like I said, delighted to see him. And so I think the took you long enough and Qui-Gon's entire disposition for that conversation is just so quintessentially Qui-Gon. I love it.
It really is. Yeah, it was a very good way to do that, to end it on just a little bit of a lighthearted note.
Yeah.
And kind of kind of inaugurating the next stage of Obi-Wan's journey, his kind of the spiritual journey he's gonna go on for the rest of his time there on Tatooine.
Right.
So my favorite line of dialogue comes from a character that, because there's so many other characters and so many other heady stuff we can get a chance to talk about, It comes from the Grand Inquisitor. Mm-hmm. And I just want to use this as a sidebar, not talking about Rupert Friend as the Grand Inquisitor is delightful.
He is.
I love him. I love his deliveries. Like, I like everything. Like, it's not the Jason Isaacs Grand Inquisitor.
In no, terms of, like, I agree.
The personality and the cadence and delivery, but it is still so wonderful. There's so many, like the Jedi code is like an itch. He cannot help but scratch it. Like, yeah. And they're like, hello, third sister. Revenge does wonders for the will to live. Every time. And so my pick comes from among those selections of Rupert Friend's deliveries, and it is from part two. It is his third sister, I can stand the reek of your ambition no longer.
It's a very, like, emperor line, isn't it?
Yes. Yes. I, like, the amount of times I have thought about that line since I first heard it is a lot. So, yeah, I love Rupert Friend's Grand Inquisitor. Like, mm-hmm. You know, if someone were to ask me, like, what is the best performance on this show? Like, who gave the best performance on the show? I would say it's probably, like, a neck and neck and neck between, like, Ewan, Vivian, and Moses.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's parsing hairs. If someone asked me, what's my favorite performance? It's Rupert Friend. I think he does a lot with, like, he's not necessarily, like, a main character. He's more in the kind of supporting role. But, like, when he's on screen, it's really good.
It is. I'm glad they included him. It would not make sense for him not to be a part of this story.
Agreed. Definitely. So on that note, we will wrap up this conversation of Obi-Wan Kenobi. So thank you, Kelly, for joining me for digging into the show. There's, of course, a lot more we could have talked about in the context of the show, but in the interest of not having this go on for hours and hours, we've talked about these facets, and I think we got some really good stuff.
Thank you for having me. It was really fun.
So before we wrap up, I'm going to ask you to the two things that I ask every first-time guest by mm-hmm. way of closing. First, to recommend a piece of Star Wars media that you think people should check out. And that could be movies, books, comics, canon, legends, whatever.
Since we were talking about Qui-Gon, if you want to know what he's been up to before he says hi to Obi-Wan, the last three episodes of the Clone Wars Season 6, where Yoda goes on his own little journey, I highly recommend watching those three to look at the Force in a new way.
Oh, yeah. The Yoda arc in Season 6, yeah, is very, yeah. very good. Yeah, it is one of those arcs where it gets into the weird Star Wars, which I love, mm-hmm. like the weird mm-hmm. Force stuff. It's the thing you watch and you realize, oh, you really don't understand what midichlorians are.
Yeah. You're like, oh, there's a lot more to this than I realized.
Yes. And then the second, before I ask you the second thing, it's going to be related, which is about pretty much just plugging your stuff. But I should have asked this as the actual wrap up to the Obi-Wan conversation, which is that, you know, as I mentioned at the top of the episode, you know, you've got this book coming out, Be More Obi-Wan. I think it's going to be coming out probably like within days that this episode itself releases.
Mm-hmm.
I got a copy at Celebration, so I've already read it.
Thanks!
It is a delightful little book. There is a two-page spread that particularly warmed my heart. It is the General Grievous two-page spreader.
Oh, yeah.
I love General Grievous, so when I flipped to that, I'm like, this is my favorite page in the book. I have found it. And so one of the things that I'm curious about is, you know, having watched this show and the story that we get and the characters that, you know, Obi-Wan interacts with and meets in the context of the show, like, is there anything from the show, any lesson, any moral, whatever, any character moment or any quote or something that you would put into Be More Obi-Wan if you had, like, a second edition?
Ah, that's a great question. I would like to say the how do you feel when you're, you know, scared of the dark and you turn on the light. I feel like that was such, first of all, like such a relatable way to describe the Force, not only to a child, but to the audience. And then, of course, you know, you can draw the lesson there of what you consider turning the light on. And I think that's also as part of your favorite episode. I think they did that on purpose, making him scared of the dark around Darth Vader. And eventually he, you know, he accepts the Force again and turns on the light. And by the end, he's not scared anymore of Vader. So I think that that little lesson right there, I think I would have fought to get into to be more Obi-Wan.
Yeah, that's a really good, yeah, description of the Force. It's a great little line. And yeah, it's just, it's another one of the additions to the catalog of different ways that the Force is described and interpreted. And, you know, we get, of course, in High Republic, all the different ways mm-hmm. that all those Jedi perceive the Force. And then we get, the OG Obi-Wan explanation about the energy field. And then we get mm-hmm. like Luke and the Last Jedi with Rey. But yeah, this is just another great little slice of like one way to perceive and look at the Force. Yeah, I really like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess that question is the good segue to the second thing that I want you to do, which is plug away, plug your stuff. Where can people find you, et cetera, et cetera.
Sure. Be More Obi-Wan will be out on July 12th here in the United States. I think it's actually out already in the United Kingdom. So you can find that at bookstores, Amazon, all the regular places. Star Wars Every Day, which I did the crafts for with Ashley Eckstein, will be out October 25th. That's coming out from Inside Editions, and it's got crafts and recipes by Elena Craig and some general life advice for getting a little bit of Star Wars in your everyday by Ashley. And it's just as bright and happy and sunny as she is. It's really pretty, really great book. And you can always find me at StarWars.com with crafts and features and interviews, and on Twitter at Kelly_Knox. I'm on there way too often, so you can find me there anytime.
All right. Fantastic. Once again, Kelly, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you again.
So what to expect on the next episode? Episode 40, the 40th episode of this show, will drop on August 1st, which just so happens to be the 2-year anniversary of A Larger View of the Force. And on that episode, we will be talking about a book, specifically Delilah S. Dawson's novel Phasma, which tells the origin story of one Captain Phasma. It is a Star Wars story, really, I would say, unlike any other. And in that episode, I want to get into the story of Phasma and that book. And joining me for that analysis and breakdown is a quite special guest to me. It is the one and only Meg Dowell. She will be here to talk about the character of Phasma, the book Phasma. And so, yeah, I am very much looking forward, needless to say, to having that conversation and to get to share it with all of you. Until then, make sure you're subscribed to the show. Please rate and review the show if you're able to do so. If you're not already following the show on Twitter, you can do so at A Larger View Pod. And until next time, look for the Force, and you will always find me.